This is Backstory, the show that takes a topic from the here and now and puts it in historical context. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century history guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century history guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century history guy. Today on the show, memorialization. How do we Americans live with our dead, and how has that changed over time? So far, we've been focusing mostly on war dead, but we're going to open up the discussion now to include ordinary non-war death as well. As we do with all of our shows, we've been soliciting your ideas about today's topic on our website, backstoryradio.org. And our producers have invited a few of you to join us on the phone.
Hey, guys. We have a call from the great state of Vermont. In Burlington, we have Josh on the line. Josh, welcome to Backstory.
Good morning.
Hey, death, a cheery subject. What's on your mind?
Well, I work for a consumer education organization called Funeral Consumers Alliance, and what we do is try to help people understand what their legal rights and options are.
Yeah.
And it's always interested me when I talk to people what they consider to be what they call funeral traditions. And a lot of what people consider to be traditional, they seem rarely to be purely organic, but we often say that, you know, what the contemporary funeral industry calls a traditional funeral is largely a commercially created tradition. And I'd love to hear what you guys think about that.
Hey, Josh wants to know if funerals are simply another product that high capitalism has produced with a veneer of tradition. What a cynic you are, Josh.
I'm a realist.
Yeah.
Well, let me give you an example of something I just recently discovered. The United States is unique in the ritual of dressing up the dead person with makeup and all, as if...
You betcha.
Yeah.
You bet it's unique.
Which suggests to me that that's hardly a tradition if we're the only people who do it, because the whole idea is that we're doing this in some universal human trait, but that's not the case at all. Where did that come from? Do you know?
Well, yes. I mean, the short history of what I call the modern American funeral after the Civil War really came about because chemical embalming was invented during the Civil War and proved very useful for getting soldiers home from the battlefield. And it was in the last quarter of the 19th century that it was the first time there was a professional industrial class of undertakers that began to be called funeral directors. And as I understand it, before that time, funerals were a much more family-centered event insofar as the person would be cared for, washed, dressed, and laid out at home, often by women in the family, mm-hmm. and the family would take a more direct role. And
well, ironically, I'm not usually much one for technological determinism, but here's a case where the embalming process made possible and even suggested that it would be appropriate to string out the funeral process.
Yep.
You could actually have the viewing and all that. I mean, mm-hmm. not to be morbid, but the clock is ticking otherwise without mm-hmm. that process, right?
Yeah, and Josh and Ed, I think embalming is very important, but also the rise of the modern hospital and places where more and more people die mm-hmm. Is a factor, too. And to just cut against the grain a little bit, Josh, I mean, that's not just trying to make a buck. That's more and more people are not dying in the home in the 20th
absolutely.
Century. And so that we need to do a bit of reinventing or recreating the notion that the family is there and they have been surrounded by loved ones when they die, even though that's not the case.
So do you find that there's a kind of a swelling wave of resentment against these things? Or are people coming to you, Josh, with increasing regularity?
Oh, well, we have always, at the organization, had a huge number of inquiries from the public. But interestingly, in this economic downturn, something is happening, I think, culturally, that our organization has been trying to get people to think about, but the economy is doing a better job maybe
right.
than we have, which is people are not only finding ways to save money on the funeral, it's an opportunity to rethink the values that we associate with funerals. People are rediscovering that old traditions can be reinterpreted in ways that don't cost them a mortgage payment.
Yeah, so, but to be fair about old traditions, Josh, if we go back to the colonial period, my time, at funerals it would be required to give out gloves. And it's a form of what anthropologists call potlatch, gift giving, in order to establish and reaffirm social status. So funerals were very, very expensive in the colonial period and this conspicuous display. And one of the austerity measures that revolutionaries and patriots promoted was to chill it on the big death deal.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Did this cut across socioeconomic levels?
Well, no, because only the rich could do this, and it would be an opportunity to reaffirm it.
Interesting. Because another saying that a lot of us frequently toss around is the poor pay more. And what we mean by that is we find that people who are middle class and with higher incomes, more college education, tend statistically to be the ones who go for the simple creations. And it's working class people who often will try to spend more on the funeral. Is this a modern phenomenon?
No, well, I think there's a long history to it, and you might say it's sort of dying up an opportunity. When you die, you show respect. And the respect that this person is as good as anybody. Don't think that because we're poor that we don't die well. This is a moment in which we're going to assert, you could say, that in death all men are created equal. And of course, people who are the favored and the privileged and the very wealthy, they don't need to make this clear in quite that way.
They don't need to show it off.
No.
Interesting.
Josh, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you very much. You guys are fun. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory. We're the American History Guys, and we're marking Memorial Day with a show about the history of death and dying. Peter, who do we have the honor of speaking with next?
It's Sherry, Brian, from the town of Marion, Virginia. Sherry, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you.
And we're talking about death, and we're trying to keep up a lively conversation. What's on your mind?
I have two interrelated questions that I'd like to ask, if I may.
Yep.
How has the replacement of the once common practice of dying at home with the modern hospital experience affected how we view death and life?
Mm-hmm.
And what has our fear and avoidance of the process of dying cost us in terms of how we understand the world in which we live?
Well, these are terrific questions, Sherry. And that is, how has the death experience been shaped by modern medicine away from home?
Yes.
And then, how do we think about it, right?
Right.
Well, I think this is one of these back-to-front questions where we start with the 20th century.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. And I remember reading some study about the average number of deaths you see in the average Hollywood film. People are getting blown away in very graphic form. And I think that one of the reasons that we have so much mediated violence, violence that is not real, that comes through the media, is we are not exposed to real death and to the real pain entailed in all of that, as people, I think, in Ed's century and Peter's century were. And that's my clever way of handing your tough question over to the other two guys.
Well, I'm going to be contrarian here. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that what Brian just said is the case. But I guess I would suggest that every indication is that people want it to be out of the house and mediated.
Oh, yeah.
You know, people were glad to have embalming. It spread quite rapidly in the second half of the 19th century, which says two things. One, that people didn't really want the corporeal experience of death, which is just profoundly unsettling and unpleasant and dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, what embalming did is allowed people to prolong the act of departure long enough that you could come and pay honor to the lost one, to be able to feel some kind of closure.
So it's still, dying takes place in the home, of course, unless it's an accident. I mean, part of our story is, when do hospitals clean up their acts sufficiently so that that is the indicated place for people in critical medical condition at end of life to be there? Because even now, of course, hospitals are places where you get a lot of infections. It's the big scandal of modern hospitals. It's a great place to go and die.
And there's no question that technology has advanced, and it became, starting in the 20th century, but especially after World War II, a lot safer to go to hospitals. But I think we got to talk about cost here, because even though hospitals became safer, the combination of studies that showed rates of infection with trying to cut costs have led to a movement of getting people out of hospitals as quickly as possible. It's also the hospice movement.
And
that's really taken off in the last two decades, I would say. And it's in part been a very, I think, important need to treat people in a humane fashion, to not have them die as vegetables with tubes coming out of them, combined with a great interest on the part of insurance companies to cut down on costs. All right, Peter, you've played out the string.
Okay, we are going back to the
18th century, whether Sherry wants to go there or not.
Sherry, you can hang up anytime. This is the boring part. No, listen, back in the 18th century and
people
before,
really died back then.
They just died, and I think it's true. It's not as extraordinary as it seems to us, an individual's death. The thing is that people die all the time in the home, and it's a fact of life, or I should say a fact of death. It's right there in your face, you might say. It happens so often, and the idea of death, it's in the context of the family, and families replace dead people. Now, that sounds pretty brutal, but if you lose a child, often that name would be used for another child.
Yeah.
That is, there's a kind of an interchangeability, because what comes first is the family, not the individual. So, of course, individuals die. It's a traumatic thing at any time in history, but we've made it our very special kind of drama and trauma, and we have therefore paradoxically insulated ourselves from what we take to be the most devastating and hurtful aspects of it, because we've made it into a kind of a secularized religious experience, whether or not we're very religious people.
Sherry, I want to ask you what prompts your question.
What prompted my question?
Yes.
I grew up in a nursing home in the mountains of Virginia.
Wow.
And we lived downstairs, and the patients lived upstairs, anywhere from 8 to 10 patients.
Mm-hmm.
So my formative years were spent with old people, and it was a very rich and wonderful experience that I really cherish.
And what was your reaction to the inevitable likelihood that they died all the time?
Well, the first person I saw die, I was 8 years old. He was a retired mill operator. He adopted my sister and I as his children.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he actually died, I was devastated. And I witnessed other deaths as well in this nursing home. These were people with whom we were intimately connected. This was not an institutionalized home.
No, I understand.
But these experiences shaped my worldview. I knew early that we lead this world, and there, without romanticizing death, because there is nothing romantic about the process of dying, there is mystery to it. There is a moment of peace after the process of death that is sacred ground, whether you're religious or not.
Yeah.
Right.
And so how it shaped my worldview and my value system is that, for one thing, I never really cared about material things because I knew how empty the pursuit of a false material world was early on.
Let me ask you, Sherry, your story is remarkably idiosyncratic in our age. Do you have any suggestions for ways in which larger numbers of people might experience that mystery, those mysterious moments that you grew up with on a regular basis, or that Peter's folks back and Ed's folks, for that matter, experienced on a regular basis?
Well, probably to not be afraid of death, for the person who's dying, to help them make the transition from death to the next world, if that's what you believe, or to the end of this life and some sort of peace. Because people who are dying need to talk about what they are going through.
Yeah.
And they're prohibited from doing that because people who are still here are afraid.
Yeah, that's a great point. Sherry, I think we should just devote this show to you, to tell you the truth.
Well, I'm,
to be perfectly honest.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling, Sherry. Great call.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry.
That's wonderful.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, in my time of dying, Well, we're just about out of time. But before we go, Brian and Peter, I want to play for you guys one more piece of tape from my visit to Hollywood Cemetery. Remember, I was sharing that earlier with you in the show, Dr. Hunter McGuire. This one I say for last because, well, let's just say it evokes a certain sense of closure. All I'll say in the way of setup for this is that for many years, Hollywood has been reserving space in a special section of the cemetery for those who serve as president of the University of Richmond. And as you guys know, just last year, I took up that job myself. Well, I'm having the unusual sensation of standing at a place that's been reserved for my burial site. I'm at the University of Richmond section of Hollywood Cemetery. I'm proud and somewhat relieved to see that we're on a beautiful knoll that lets us look off in enormous distances in every direction. And what I look around seeing are remarkable sculptures of everything from a Celtic cross there that could have been 1,000 years old to lilies of the field to Egyptian obelisks. It sort of reminds you that, like American history that I've spent my life studying, these things last, that there are marks on the land. And who knows, maybe one day there'll be a mark here for me in some way.
I have to remember how to get here. So it's actually pretty close to the entrance, isn't it?
Here it is.
Well, Ed, I want to ask you, since Peter and I don't have burial plots reserved for us at the University of Virginia.
But we're looking.
Yeah, we're looking. tell me, what did that feel like, looking at your own gravesite?
Well, it was a little spooky to think about it. You know, and you look around, you see, if you were going to have some words attached to you forever, what would they be? Maybe. He was one of the history guys.
One of the history guys. That's very beautiful.
Okay. Well, guys, it's time to inter this show. As always, 1 hour was barely enough to scratch the surface of things. And we'll be waiting for you online to continue the discussion. You can find us at backstoryradio.org. All of our past shows are archived there, and you can sign up for our free podcast and newsletter as well.
You'll also find a special bonus feature along with this week's show post. It's an audio slideshow featuring Michael Lessey, author of the unusual book of photographs called Wisconsin Death Trip.
Again, that's backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson.
Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Support also comes from Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Claire Gargalli and David Carley, J.M. Weinberg, and Caroline Feeney.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.